books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and today we've got a trio of summer reads. Plus we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library. Later on in today's show, we'll hear from the Queen of the Beach Reads, Sophie Gravier, who was having a hot girl summer. We'll reminisce with Sue Moorcroft, who had a summer on a sunny island released during the pandemic. But first, a mystery set in the summer. Isabel Ashdown is the author of One Girl, One Summer. One Girl, One Summer is the new high-cap mystery from Isabel Ashdown, in which a stranger comes to town, literally by falling from the skies above. On a peaceful hillside campsite in the heat of summer, a private plane crash lands. Several are killed and many more lives are shattered, including those of the Gale family who owns the site. The audio version of One Girl, One Summer is read by Antonia Beamish.
As Nell contemplated her descent, the wind rose, whipping through her red curls and causing her oversized shirt to flap like a sail. She grew aware of a small aeroplane approaching from out over the water, the distant burr of its engine like the pleasing hum of a lawnmower on a lazy Sunday morning. How ordinary she must appear to the approaching pilot, she thought, high overhead in the cloudless sky. How carefree. Ha! If they only knew the half of it. In a sudden change of direction, the plane swooped away again, veering off along the coast and further out above the shimmering water. Nell wished she were in that small plane. She wished she were anywhere but here. Nearly 19, and still at home, while the best of her friends headed off to uni and the worst of them stuck around, seemingly happy enough to stay in high cap forever, having babies and marrying the boy next door. She checked the time on her phone. It wasn't yet 7 a.m, and other than that circling plane, all was still. The main road below had been empty for at least the past 10 minutes, but now a vehicle appeared, and, as it turned in through the campsite gates below, she recognised it as her mother's battered orange Citroen. Nell traced its journey along the well-tended path past Goldie and the farm shop and the various communal blocks until it stopped near the children's playground in a parking bay reserved for staff. At once, Nell remembered she was meant to be at home with Albie for Mum's early cleaning shift, a concession she'd grudgingly agreed to last night before she'd slammed the front door on their argument. "Just get him to tennis practice at 8, Mum had called after her, with a dismissive flap of her fag hand, one foot inside the kitchen, one out the back door. "Then you can do whatever you like." "Ha! Anything except go travelling," Nell had yelled back, shrill with rage.
One Girl, One Summer, it opens on a peaceful hilltop campsite in the heat of summer when a private plane crash lands onto a countryside campsite. Several people are killed and many more lives are shattered or destroyed, including those of members of the family called the Gales, who own the campsite and who have a member of their family seriously injured in this plane crash. It's a sort of multi-narrative story which allows us to sort of see into the points of view of 18-year-old teenager Nell Gale, who is gripped with guilt because her brother is one of the victims and she was meant to be looking after him and had failed to do so on that day. And also her mother, who she has this tense relationship with. And then the third voice, another woman in the story, is D.I. Ali Sampson, who comes in halfway through to launch an investigation both into the air crash but also into a series of other crimes that have been taking place in this small coastal Dorset town of Highcap.
Mum? Nell spoke into the phone, but her voice was muffled beneath the roar. Albie was still balanced at the top of the skate ramp, waiting for his sister, or perhaps transfixed by the spectacle himself. And for long seconds, Nell could not move. Inert, she was gripped by the strongest sensation of drifting high above herself, high above them all, helpless with certainty that another bad thing was about to happen.
Nell?
Mum's voice echoed through the handset. But later, Nell wouldn't be sure whether she'd imagined it, because the next thing she heard was the bone-crunching explosion of metal and glass as the campsite below her disappeared behind a vast cloud of billowing grey dust. Caravans and tents and a child's bright red skateboard toppled, toy-like, across the green coastal plain, and Aunt Susie's Land Rover ploughed headlong into the giant golden rabbit.
It shares a bit of DNA with Homecoming, as in it's set in Highcap, and we get a mention of the starlings. But it is a standalone novel. You can read it without having read Homecoming.
That's right. So I haven't so far, this is my 10th novel, but I haven't so far written any sort of series of books. But this one, it shares the universe of Highcap, I suppose. It's also set in a contemporary time. Highcap is an imagined blend of places that I know on the West Dorset coast. It's sort of Lyme Regis and Bridport, it's countryside and it's coast. I very much fell in love with the area many years ago and have now made it my home. And Highcap to me represents, you know, all the things that are wonderful about that Dorset coast, but it also gives me the opportunity to explore those wonderful smaller communities where big things happen. You know, big things happen to people, don't they? Small things on a global scale are actually enormous in small communities and within families. So within this story, it's very much the same location. We share one character, which is the detective, although it's not truly a police procedural type of detective story. This character comes back in, and I quite enjoyed bringing her back in and just developing her with a light touch as she helps to bring forward the characters that are so important in One Girl, One Summer.
Yeah, it seems like you've taken a family, albeit the dysfunctional family, but what family isn't, and sort of thrown a grenade in the form of a plane and amongst them all.
Yes, you know, I also teach creative writing, and so I have huge fascination about, you know, the aspects of storytelling and, you know, what makes story work and what are the themes of a story. And I think it was the novelist John Gardner once said there are only two types of story. There's the character goes on an adventure or a stranger comes to town. And so with this particular book, at the very opening, I figured, well, what if that stranger just drops from the sky? You know, what bigger kind of arrival could there be? And so, of course, we have this pilot dropping from the sky and he becomes known as the unknown pilot. As the world tries to work out who he is and where he came from.
It's narrated by Antonia Beamish. Was there a discussion at the start about using two narrators?
Yes, all of my books have gone to audio, and I'm very fortunate with my publisher, Orion, that at the early stages, I'm always sent a fairly decent shortlist that they have selected. And it varies from book to book because, of course, we've got three voices, three, you know, narrative strands here. So we could have chosen three narrators. We could have chosen two. In this case, the guys in the audio team came to me and said, actually, we think that one narrator would work equally well for these three characters. And Antonia Beamish was one of the shortlist. And, you know, listening to some samples, I felt that she could do a really good job of those three different voices. You know, I've had all sorts of narrators in the past. I've had Imogen Church, Sarah Novak, Emily Joyce, you know, all wonderful narrators. And it's quite a tough job deciding, you know, who would really represent it well. But I think she's done a great job.
Do you never fancy narrating one of your own books yourself?
No, I love reading extracts of my book. You know, when I do a book event in a bookstore or on a podcast or on a recording. But actually, I like to limit myself to about 5 minutes. So, I think it takes a very particular skill. You know, many of these voice actors are actors, in person too. And whilst I know the beats of my book, I think those voice actors really, really put some life into it. And they've got that distance, I think, which is really useful. I'm rather wedded to every word that I've written, and they're seeing it for the first time. And I think, all hats, all credit to them. I couldn't do it.
Do you listen to a lot of audiobooks yourself?
I do. I'm a voracious reader, and but I don't have enough hours in the day. I'd love to be able to sit and read, for hours on end, but I have to write, I have to do other, I do other work. So, a few years ago, I started listening to Audible books, and then discovered that libraries were offering a selection of audiobooks too. And so I usually get through at least one a week while I'm washing up or cooking or doing housework or other things. So they have formed a really important backdrop to my consumption of stories. Just as actually, watching television programs like, and movies and listening to radio dramas. I believe all story is story, because you do still get some people who are a little bit sniffy about listening to stories rather than reading the text. But I'm a huge fan. I can't get enough of audiobooks, to be honest.
Now, one thing I noticed, I maybe got an early version of it, but did the name of One Girl, One Summer change at some point?
It did. So this was one of those things that happens in publishing. So we were sort of, hurtling towards the point at which we would share the cover. The cover reveal for an author is always a nice moment where you can kind of share what your book looks like, what the name of the book is. And right before, in fact, I think on the day that I was going to be sharing those things, I got a phone call from my publisher saying, we need to talk about the name. And this is one of those examples where the sales team, rather than the creative or editorial team, the sales team have an influence on what your book, the final package is. So I think there were two things at work there. One was the sales team felt like Weathering, which was the name, wasn't as good as it could be for this particular type of book. And the other thing was, I had noticed actually, very shortly before my book, another book came out with the same name, Weathering. Different genre, but it sort of felt like it was wrong. So we had to pivot very quickly and go through our shortlist of names and sort of wrestle ourselves into a position where we were all happy with One Girl, One Summer, which I love actually now, because it really has a sort of, it almost has a sense of place just in those four words. We changed the cover too, so everything ground to a halt, and the book went out. It launched on time, but it was all crunched up at the end. But these things happen in publishing.
Yeah, it wasn't until the plane crashed that I was sure I was reading the right book. You mentioned the cover. One thing we'll miss, actually, if we download the book from RNIB Tone Books, is the cover. Could you give us a little description of it?
Yes, so the description of the cover is, we have a sort of sunset evening sky with a woman standing at the end of one of those wooden walkways that you'd walk across to reach the beach on certain stretches of many, in fact, across the world, these sort of wooden walkways that lead you down to the sand. There's a gentle breeze in the air, and the reeds are kind of blowing, and the girl is looking out towards the sunset. So it's a lone figure, very much representing the main character, this 18-year-old Nell, who should be on the brink of the summer of her life, having finished A levels and with all the adventures ahead of her. But this plane comes down, and an event that we don't understand until later in the book has also occurred to Nell the night before. And it becomes an event that she now cannot speak of, because the effects of this plane crash and the effects on her family and on her brother are too great for her to be able to deal with the trauma that she herself is hiding.
With rigid fingers, she fumbled to get a grip on her phone and dialed 999. This, Nell would recognise later, would be her flashbulb moment. The memory she would recall forevermore. A vivid Technicolor showreel of where she was when it happened, in the seconds that separated the before from the after. "Ambulance!" she cried when the operator connected at the other end. "There's been a plane crash at the Golden Rabbit Holiday Park on the Port Regis to Mere Road at the foot of Highcap Hill. I'm there now. I'm on the hill. I can see everything."
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, I'm Ray Sawyer. I've been reading for the RNIB Talking Books for 25 years now. My first book was Coming From Behind by Howard Jacobson, but the one I think I enjoyed most was Writing Home by Alan Bennett. Not just because it's wonderful writing, but although not officially an autobiography, you've got a sense of his life as all his selections of writings were put in chronological order. I particularly like The Lady in the Van. The Talking Book studios, as now, were very close to where Alan Bennett lived, and I was able to walk up and actually see the driveway and the house in which the lady lived for 25 years. And quite by chance, Alan Bennett was sitting on his front step reading The Guardian when I turned up.
This van, there were to be three others in the course of the next 20 years, was originally brown. But by the time it had reached the Crescent, it had been given a coat of yellow. Miss S was fond of yellow. It's the papal colour. And was never content to leave her vehicles long in their original trim. Sooner or later, she could be seen moving slowly round her immobile home, thoughtfully touching up the rust from a tiny tin of primrose paint, looking, in her long dress and sun hat, much as Vanessa Bell would have looked had she gone in for painting Bedford vans. Miss S. never appreciated the difference between car enamel and ordinary gloss paint, and even this she never bothered to mix. The result was that all her vehicles ended up looking as if they'd been given a coat of badly made custard or plastered with scrambled egg. Still, there were few occasions on which one saw Miss Shepherd genuinely happy, and one of them was when she was putting paint on.
I love doing the Talking Books because, well, you get to play parts that you'd never get to play in real life. In fact, doing a book is a bit like doing a one-man show, only one that's 25 hours long.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Next on Read On's Summer Read Special, let's hear from Sue Moorcroft. This was recorded a wee while ago with Red Sail, and Sue not only talks about her book Summer on a Sunny Island, but also about writing and publishing during the pandemic.
Well, my characters are doing something I dearly like to do myself, and that's spend a summer in Malta. It's obviously not going to happen this summer, but I was brought up for several years in Malta. So sending characters there is always a pleasure for me anyway, and I managed to visit four times last year in the pursuit of research, obviously. So Rosa's mum, Dory, is an army kid like I was, and Zach's dad, Steve, is an army kid, and they were at school together. And it's through that connection that they end up in adjacent apartments owned by Zach's grandmother, who's Maltese. And he's a bit of a bad lad by reputation, but it's actually more that he's fought for the underdog and it's got him on the wrong side of the law initially when he was 18 and then again when he was 30. But it's created an awful lot of trouble between him and his dad, Steve. And so he's gone away to the island for the summer to help his grandmother to look after her property for her because she's not able to do it herself. She lives in the UK and his grandfather needs care. And Rosa's left a bit of a mess behind in the UK because Marcus, her ex-boyfriend, got them in a mess with online gambling and the relationship ended. Rosa's mum, Dory, as well as being an army kid, is a bit of a celeb cook. And she's spending summer on the islands, Mediterranean cooking. And she invites Rosa out there to be her personal assistant and kitchen porter. So that's why they're all out there in the first place.
And as I've come to expect with your plots, they clearly have a lot to untangle before they can even feel ready to move on.
That's exactly my starting point, really. They're both at crossroads and realise that everything they thought that was keeping them in one place actually wasn't. And they almost get overwhelmed by the choices available to them, and they find that what they want they can't really get.
Rosa twirled her wine glass, trying to choose her words over the chatter and clatter of Gino's pavement cafe and the rumble of traffic along the seafront road. Here in the busy area of Salima, new buildings outnumbered the old, and the promenade was filled with people selling harbour cruises to tourists. Rosa preferred Taj Beach, where she was staying, about a mile along the coast, with its traditional stone villas. Salima's air was punctuated by the sound of car horns, but in Taj Beach, you could sometimes catch the mellow sound of church bells rising into the blue sky above the boats bobbling on the sparkling sea. The Maltese sun was setting in a blaze of lilac and pink. In the sea creek, a row of red and blue ferries bobbed at their moorings. Over the buzzing traffic, Rosa could see their lights coming on. Beyond them, the skyline of the capital city, Valletta, on the other side of Marsamshet Harbour, was becoming a silhouette of ramparts and domes and spires.
Leslie Harcourt narrating Summer on a Sunny Island by my guest, Sue Moorcroft. Normally, I invite you on to the show at Christmas to talk about your wonderful Middle Dip series of winter warmers where everybody's wrapped up against the cold. But you, of course, have a string of summer romances. If people visit the catalogue in the RNIB library, they can travel to France and Italy and obviously now Malta as well. Which came first, the summer books or the winter books?
Well, I have a backlist with another publisher, but they didn't follow quite the same pattern. I suppose I'm going to say the winter book because after those other books that could have taken place, you know, the season was really not that important, although there is another Malta book, The Wedding Proposal, that does take place over a summer, but that's more happenstance than an actual commercial decision. But when I was still with that publisher, I was doing a signing in a local bookshop and it was November and I just watched all the Christmas books walking out of the store because people were buying them as Christmas gifts and thought it looked a good gift with Christmas or winter in the title. So I thought, well, that's what I'll do next then. Around the same time, I made the decision to try and move to a bigger publisher, one who could get me into supermarkets, and saw my next step down the road towards that was getting a really good agent who I really gelled with. And so I did. I got Juliet Pickering at Blake Friedman, and we really do share ambitions and visions, and we can be transparent with each other, which makes working together so, so easy. And so I had that Christmas book ready, if you like, and that was the book that became The Christmas Promise. And the next idea I had was simply that I had a summer one. Summer idea was next. It was just happenstance because I have a friend who I'd gone out to dinner with and she said to me, let me tell you about my holiday from hell. And I said, oh, yes, do. So when I was ready to pitch my book, it so happened HarperCollins had this slot open up for somebody who would do a Christmas book and then a summer book because somebody had been doing it and they'd gone to another publisher. And so Juliet rocked up with this book oven ready and one that was part written. When you're planning your career as an author, what you can't plan are the rolls of the dice, as I call them, when things go against you or go for you and they're completely out of your control. All you can do is write the best books. This opportunity just opened up and that's what they want from me, and so that's what I keep giving them,
and with great success. One thing I do know about you is that you write your winter book in the summer and your summer book in the winter, so I'm wondering if the next Middle Dip winter novel is going to be particularly about isolation and be even closer knit than the previous ones have been.
Well, I can tell you it's not because it's already written. The first draft is finished. You're quite correct that I do work on the opposite season, but it's a bit of a rolling process. So the first draft of the winter book is due in at the end of March. So I got that in at the end of March, and it's called A Christmas Wish. And now I'm waiting for the edits. So I'll be editing it as the weather gets warmer and warmer. And the edits come in two or three rounds, and then there's the proofs. So that keeps coming back to me over the summer. And I'm planning another book in between. So it's actually the summer 2021 book that I've just begun planning, which is set in Italy. And I've already had the conversation with my editor. Should I be setting it in Italy, or should I bring it to the UK? But she has come to the conclusion that we won't know until further along in the process exactly what the answer is to that question. But she feels I ought to write the book I was going to write anyway, before we were put into lockdown, and we may have to tweak it. And that happens for all kinds of reasons, not just because of a pandemic. Brexit has been causing me headaches with my books for at least the last four books because of the uncertainty. And even The Christmas Promise, which was set completely in the UK, I had an issue where the law was changed. It was changed on revenge porn, and whereas it had been under the law of harassment and stalking, they decided to create a law specifically for the offence. So part of the book had to be rewritten to incorporate that. So it's not an unknown thing to change direction a little bit and have to tweak. You can only do it really up until the last few weeks before it goes to the typesetter, but it's not an unknown situation. I've never had it quite, obviously, as it is at the moment. I can remember my son, when he was very little, saying to his brother, and I have to hasten to add, this is not the way I taught my children to cross the road, but he was going to cross the road, and he said, let's hold hands and cross our fingers, close our eyes and hope there are no cars coming. And that's a bit how I feel about my book at the moment. The book I'm planning is, I'm crossing fingers and hoping for the best with it.
I know a lot of authors are very concerned about promoting the books that they are publishing at the moment and missing out on the book launches and the readings and meeting the readers. I worry slightly less about you because how active you are on social media. You're managing to spread the word in pretty much exactly the same way as before.
That's true. The big difference is all the events being virtual. So I've done events for the Avon Book Fest with other authors, and for my VLF, my virtual literary festival, and for Curl Up with Kathy, which is an event with Kathy Bramley that she puts out personally. And I'm going to be doing some Facebook Lives, one for Kim Nash, who is an author and also a publicist and has quite a big following, and for Tamworth Book Club, and for someone else who hasn't given me their name yet. They've just gone quiet, so I hope they're not poorly. And so all these events, and I shall do one on my own author page, I think, on the evening. It's the 30th of April that the book comes out in paperback, audio and ebook. And so I'm going to have to force myself to open a bottle of champagne and have a little virtual drink with people on Facebook. That is the major change to promo, I would say. The other major changes are all the bookshops are shut. Now, independent and high street chains are providing pretty sturdy alternatives of home delivery. And the distributors have opened their home delivery arms under current government guidance to facilitate it. So we can still get paperbacks. And of course, if we're lucky enough to be in supermarkets, which my books normally are, we can still get them at many supermarkets. I'm really grateful to supermarket staff, actually, not just from the book point of view, but just to keep us all going under difficult circumstances. So the paperback has been treated quite differently. The supply chain has had to change, because obviously ebooks and audio and remote lending from libraries, you can't go and borrow a print book at the moment. These other things, ebooks and audio, are all going forward as before, and podcasts like yours. And I'm doing the same with my radio interviews. I'm doing them over the telephone. So, yeah, we've adapted. But I think maybe we're lucky that with people on furlough, they're reading. It's not all they're doing, obviously, but they have more time to read. And although I'm aware that not every method of reading puts money in the author's pocket. We're hoping that enough does, that it's not going to impact too much on our income, unless our income is very much events-based, which for some writers, like Writers for Children, it can be.
Well, as you say, the audiobook downloads are not affected, and maybe you will see a bit of a spike in sales. Certainly, the narration by Leslie Harcourt of Summer on a Sunny Island is terrific.
Well, she seems very nice. I've actually spoken to her on the telephone because of the Maltese words, because she did a little sample for the audio department at HarperCollins, and they shared that with me. And I almost always say yes when they share the narrator's voice with me, but it is a courtesy, which is quite important to me, obviously, because I am a big audio book consumer myself. And so I know what I like, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And one of the Maltese words she used, she mispronounced. And so I said, oh, perhaps we could have a conversation and I could tell her how to pronounce them. And she took me up on that with alacrity, which was very good of her. And she'd already read the book in print form and she'd made a list of words. And I hadn't realised how many Maltese words I'd used. And some of them were quite difficult to my English ear. And she told me one word and I said, I don't know how you say that. And she said, well, you're supposed to be telling me. I said, well, I'm sorry, but I don't know how to say it. I've only ever seen it written down. So I think she was going off to see if she could find that out from somebody else.
Well, because of our relationship with HarperCollins, the book has gone straight into the RNIB library. So members of the RNIB library will be able to enjoy it simultaneously with its publication this week.
That's wonderful to know. I'm very pleased.
Sue Moorcroft, thank you so much for whisking me and the listeners away to a sunny summer island. I wish you the very best of luck with publication and look forward to speaking to you at Christmas.
Thank you very much, Red. I look forward to it too. Keep safe.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book service and studios. The first Talking Books to be sent to listeners were on LPs made of shellac.
A shellac is like a very thick plastic, and you know, if you drop them, they just shattered, basically. The average length book, let's say 10, 12 hours, so you're talking 10, 15 discs, perhaps. They were stored in very durable boxes with large straps going around them. And those durable boxes held these discs and were sent out by post in the same sort of way as we do now, of course.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. Joseph Banks by Patrick O'Brien was given to us by HarperCollins.
The Great Southern Sea, empty on European charts, save for the odd island and caterpillar of coast, proved to have been well explored already by skilful native navigators who had populated most of what was habitable. That there was endemic tribal warfare was, in part, due to population pressure. Later, the vulnerability of the islanders to European diseases cruelly reduced numbers, and European aggression, military or cultural, disintegrated whole societies. But when Australia's arid heart and the non-existent southern continent had been subtracted from the gestat riches of the South Pacific, there was a less capacious reservoir for European overflow than might have been supposed. The moral dilemmas, which Cook sensed, seemed to have impinged less on the younger man. He was young, and coming home famous made him self-important. He had what O'Brien calls a sudden rush of pomp to the head. As a result, he missed the next boat south. A new expedition was planned. Banks demanded a larger ship and a greater degree of personal control than the Admiralty was willing to allow. In 1772, when Cook sailed, Banks was not on Resolution. This seems to have been a serious disappointment to at least one other person. Cook wrote from Madeira, 3 days before we arrived, a person left the island who went by the name of Burnett. He had been waiting for Mr. Banks' arrival about 3 months. At first, he said he came here for the recovery of his health, but afterwards said his intention was to go with Mr. Banks. He was about 30 years of age and rather ordinary than otherwise, and employed his time botanizing and so on. Every part of Mr. Burnett's behaviour and every action tended to prove that he was a woman. I have not met with a person that entertained a doubt of a contrary nature.
Botanist, explorer, president of the Royal Society, and one of Australia's founding fathers, Sir Joseph Banks was among the most influential figures of the 18th and 19th century. As a young man, he accompanied Captain Cook on his voyage of discovery to Australia. In later years, he was instrumental in establishing Kew Gardens as the greatest botanical centre in the world, and he knew just about everyone who mattered in the scientific circles of the time. Patrick O'Brien's masterly biography draws on much hitherto unpublished material. Far from being the colossus of science traditionally imagined, Joseph Banks emerges here as a warm-hearted enthusiast whose legacy survives not only in the record of his botanicising in the South Seas, but in the development of the Australian continent and in the tenor and tradition of subsequent scientific inquiry.
The same year, Banks took the team he had assembled for the Resolution voyage to Iceland. It was a useful, if unremarkable, excursion, and for Banks, it marked the end of active exploration. O'Brien compares the change in Banks's life at this time to that which affects a shellfish when, having passed through the free-swimming phase of its existence, it settles down on its chosen rock. Banks's principal place of attachment was the house in Soho Square, in which were assembled his herbarium, collections and library. There were also the family estates in Lincolnshire, and eventually Spring Grove, a house outside London. He lived with his sister even after his marriage, and the amicable nature of family relations is recorded in letters which detail the activities of Banks and his ladies.
Joseph Banks by Patrick O'Brien is read by Richard Attlee and runs for 15 hours, 40 minutes.
The Ghosts of Rome by Joseph O'Connor was given to us by Penguin Random House.
11 minutes from now, the air raid will start. No one in the room knows what's coming. The bells of the 4 vast basilicas summon the dawn, frightening away gulls from the belfries and balconies, startling wildcats from their nooks, rats from the trash cans. Outside Gestapo headquarters on Via Tasso, the sentries change guard. Across Rome, shabby shutters clack open. Mothers search cupboards, hungry children cry. Beneath the rafters of what used to be the Vatican City Casa del Pellegrino, a lodging house for pilgrims suffering from bubonic plague, 4 friends are gathered in the draughty, decrepit little chapel, where a tarpaulin is draped on the wall behind the altar to damp out the skirling breeze. Buckets have been arranged to catch the rain. Covert photographs of these people are pinned to a corkboard in Gestapo headquarters. More are being taken at this moment by a timed miniature camera hidden in a statue's eye. The Monsignor's fingertips dip to the brass bowl of ash. Drizzle blurs the window panes. His voice is hoarse and low. Memento homo, quia pulvis es, et in pulverem reverteris. Amen, says the Contessa Giovanni Landini. As he traces the ashen cross on our forehead, She closes her itching eyes. Her headache gives a pulse like a startled, scuttling insect. Not enough sleep. Never enough sleep since the war came. Anxiety, hunger, the bleat of the air raid sirens. For 13 weeks her period has not come. The dreams she's growing frightened to have. The devil curates our nightmares, a nun told her once, as the conductor of an opera drives the orchestra. Last night she dreamt again of her palazzo in the city. The somber marble staircase, the lamps, the Quattrocento ancestral portraits and oak-framed Borromini drawings, the pomegranate trees through the leaded window across the courtyard.
February 1944, 6 months since Nazi forces occupied Rome. Inside the beleaguered city, the Contessa Giovanna Landini is a member of the band of escape line activists known as the Choir. Their mission is to smuggle refugees to safety and help Allied soldiers, all under the nose of Gestapo boss Paul Hauptmann. During a ferocious morning air raid, a mysterious parachutist lands in Rome and disappears into the back streets. Is he an ally or an imposter? His fate will come to put the whole escape line at risk. Meanwhile, Hauptmann's attention has landed on the Contessa. As his fascination grows, she is pulled into a dangerous game with him, one where the consequences could be lethal.
Three art students from the Accademia making copies of the Goya, measuring with charcoals and thumbs, mutating into the trio of haloed apostles in the painting, now back to duffel-clad, russet-ringleted bohemians. The 7 great mahogany wardrobes containing her gowns. The death mask of a poet opened his eyes as she passed. She was moving through the perfumed and gilded rooms, past the sculptures and heavy sofas, the hip-high Virgin Marys, the spine of a novel by Dickens translated into French, Le Mystère d'Edwin Drood. A piano was playing an old sonata by Clementi. As usual, she had been searching for something and, as usual, hadn't found it. Paolo was there, somehow, although she had not seen him or heard him. The clock of her grandfather clock was his heartbeat. On her right side now, Darcy Osborne shifts and coughs. He is present out of the tactful curiosity that is his diplomat stock in trade and to respect his Roman Catholic friends. To her left, Delia Kiernan, here for the faith whose prelates and pieties sometimes burden her patience. Delia's daughter, Blon, and Sam Derry promised they would attend too, but they haven't. Mariana de Vries said she wouldn't. Her Dutch common sense means a lie-in on Wednesday mornings, when the escape line roster does not require her. But in she hurries now, grey-faced, bog-eyed, declining to apologise for her lateness. Mariana rarely apologises. I'm not sorry for much. Who knows why she is here? She herself doesn't know. She is one of those atheists with no interest in converting you. Her unbelief is worn in quiet comfort, like an old, beloved quilt. The Contessa finds herself silently saying the names of the quintet. Delia, Frank, Hugh, Mariana, and Joe. Around the world, across its time zones, tens of millions will attend the Ash Wednesday rite today, hearing the same dark words the Monsignor has just uttered, smoke-filled and strange and disturbing and comforting. Remember, man, thou art but dust, and to dust thou shalt return.
The Ghosts of Rome by Joseph O'Connor is read by Stephen Hogan, Barnaby Edwards, Aoife Duffin, David Joan, Gertrude Toma, and Lawrence Bouvard, and runs for 11 hours and 48 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
And finally, on today's show, let's hear about a hot girl summer from Sophie Gravia.
And among those other things is Hot Girl Summer, the new book with Ava, Grace and Rebecca. Tell us about Hot Girl Summer.
Yeah, so Hot Girl Summer is basically a book about female friendships and getting your life back on track. Obviously, romance is my niche and it's what I write about, but I was really, really keen to write a book about female friendship and sort of having romance as a subplot. So it's about three girls, and we take it from each girl's point of view during the novel. The main character's Scottish, she's Glaswegian. Her sister's Glaswegian as well, and the other girl is from Essex. And they all live in London. They've lived in London since they were teenagers. And basically, they've all sort of drifted apart. They've had their separate lives. When they were at school and at college and really, really close, they had really big ambitions and really keen to sort of make their mark in the world. The main character just went through a divorce as the novel starts, and she's found herself from living in Kensington to living in a sort of scatter flat in Croydon. So she's like really struggling, and she then goes to her high school reunion where she meets up with her other two best friends. So while they're at the high school reunion, she realises that they're not as high-flying as they think, and actually all of their life sort of drifting apart, and they decide to meet up and plan a hot girl summer where they basically get their life back on track, sort out their love lives, sort out all their careers and financial situations, and basically have the best summer they can, which is obviously all chaotic.
Ivar! Ivar, can you hear me? Even through the thick drowsiness, her voice was instantly familiar. I tried to open my eyes, which was a struggle, because they felt like they had dumbbells taped to them. You gave me a proper fright. Becca's friendly Essex accent brought a fleeting smile to my face, but my eyes squinted at the bright strip lighting above, and I scrunched them closed immediately. Ivar, babe, can you hear me? She repeated. I noticed the worry in her voice and made an effort to nod back, still groggy from surgery. My head felt like a giant block of cement. Am I okay? I croaked out. My body felt tender. Yeah, Han. The doctor said everything was removed and cleaned out.
One of the few broadcastable clips from Hot Girl Summer. Now, Sophie, was it difficult to write in a voice that's not yours, to find all those Essex phrases?
Yeah, it was difficult at times. Obviously, I'm up here in Scotland, and the Glasgow Kiss series was sort of Scottish banter, Scottish patter. But yeah, I loved doing the Essex because it just reminded me so much of Gemma Collins when I was writing it. So I would watch like clips of Gemma Collins and the things they would say and Towie and stuff like that, just trying to incorporate the lingo into the book. But it was so much fun writing about an Essex character.
Now, all four books, the Glasgow Kiss series and Hot Girl Summer, are all narrated by Kira Lucchese. Did you have any hand in the picking of the narrator for the books?
Oh yes, obviously because my publisher's based in London, so they had been sending me voice recordings of actors, and a lot of them were like Scottish Highlands. Obviously our range, our voices and our accents are completely different, but perhaps to someone in London they all sound Scottish. So I was like, she needs to be Glaswegian. They were like, no, she's definitely Scottish. I'm like, no, that is not an act, that is like far up the Highlands, that accent. So it took us a while, and then I found Kira, and she's just, I've obviously kept her on for Hot Girl Summer as well, which isn't part of the trilogy, because she's honestly so amazing. She reminds me of Robin Williams when she's doing the recordings, because she's so animated and she does all the different voices of the characters and really, really brings it to life.
Did you not fancy doing it yourself?
It did cross my mind. It crossed my mind, and then we spoke about it. And then I heard Kira, and I thought she would actually be, she was so much better at it than me. So I wanted it obviously to be the best possible version. So we went with Kira. It crossed my mind, but when I heard her, she was just so much more talented than me at recording and things like that. So I'd done the acknowledgements for Meet Me in Milan and the audio. I went through it at the studio with the guys, and oh my goodness, it's so much harder than you think. Just trying to read, and I wrote it, so I can imagine if it was someone else, but it's so much harder than you think, stumbling and you know, you're trying to cut everything out. But it was good fun, it was good experience. But yeah, I take my hat off to her for for doing it because it's a long process as well.
As I entered Tony's, a small English diner, I was greeted by a bubbly young waitress. I pointed to the booth behind her as I noticed my sister's bright red hair and wandered over to Grace, who stood up when she saw us. "Hello, my girl, I've missed you," she said as she hugged Georgie, who hugged her tightly back. "How was your holiday to see Granny?" "It was fun," Georgie giggled, taking a seat at the table. "Hey." I wrapped my arms around Grace sheepishly. "Oh, I'm so glad you guys could come," she said. She seemed hyper, a little ecstatic. "Doesn't this place bring back memories?" She smiled as I took a seat. When we moved to the city for university, we would meet here for lunch a few times a week. I glanced around the place, the same decor, tables and chairs, the same smell of built-up grease from all those years ago. We would arrange to meet, lay our books out and study for hours for exams, or come to discuss heartbreaks or crushes. It was a nostalgic, greasy part of us. I laughed. "It does." "Hola." Becca was standing behind us with her arms out. I nudged Georgie to go and hug her, and she happily obliged. "God, you're getting big, girl."
Another clip of Hot Girl Summer by Sophie Gravia. Now, what I'd normally do here is ask for an audio description of the cover, because we sometimes miss seeing the cover if we're downloading it from R&IB Talking Books, especially if we're listening on a smart speaker. And sometimes we get a nice insight into both the cover design process and an insight into the book itself, how the images reflect the content of the novel. But for a change, I'm going to do that myself. A Glasgow Kiss is red with a small bikini. What Happens in Dubai is blue with someone on a sun lounger. Meet Me in Milan is yellow with a girl waiting for a tram. And Hot Girl Summer is green with three friends, one of whom is drinking, walking away from a car that has broken down. And it has the subtitle, "You Don't Need to Grow Up to Glow Up." Now, I'm doing that because I really want to hear another cover story about how A Glasgow Kiss got its self-published cover.
Yeah. So when I had self-published A Glasgow Kiss, obviously I wanted it in a physical copy so that I had it, and not thinking that anyone else would read it, but I thought, imagine how cool it would be to know that I've made a book. So it'd be nice to have it sitting at the side of my bed. So I had went on trying to get someone to design a front cover, but it cost hundreds of pounds. It was coming up to Christmas. I was obviously on my own with the kids and I was absolutely skint. So I went on Fiverr, an app, and basically pitched to try and get someone to design a front cover. I knew exactly what I wanted. I wanted the Duke of Wellington statue, which is really renowned in Scotland, with the cone in the head and the girl sitting at the front of it. I knew exactly what I wanted. I just needed someone to design it in that format. So I found a guy from Pakistan who said that he would design the cover for 40 quid. And I was like, you know, at the time too, I actually thought, oh, that's quite a lot, like, can I afford that, blah blah blah. And then I thought, do you know what, you're never going to do anything like this again. So I said, right, okay, I'll just do it. So I paid the 40 quid, he got the cover, and that's how that came about. But do you know, it's still my favourite cover out of all of them. It's just, I think it's so iconic, and there's only so many of the books printed. So for instance, I was at a signing last night and a couple of the girls came up with the original copy and I absolutely loved it.
Are you still actually nursing just now?
Yeah, I still do 2 days a week in the hospital.
And we'll be delicate here, but you do work with people who can experience sight loss.
Yeah, so I'm a renal dialysis nurse, so a huge proportion of our patients have got sight loss or completely blind because it's part and partial of kidney disease. So yeah, it's a huge part of my job.
So now your book's in audio, it's accessible to all these people and everyone else who, for whatever reason, can't access print.
Yeah, I think the audio it's such a great thing to actually put out your books there. There's so many of my patients that listen to the audiobook as well, which is really nice. There's one particular girl and she's got vision problems and she sits at the sides and she's constantly just listening to audiobooks. That's how she passes her time when she's getting her dialysis. And she crossed my mind when I was obviously started this journey, because I knew how much she loves them. And I remember asking her for tips and stuff like that and what makes a great audiobook. So yeah, I think it's so important. And even me, I prefer an audio version than sitting down with a book. The book, just reading a book, makes me physically fall asleep. But see, being able to pop it in audio and go about and put it through Alexa and things as well, it's really good.
Have you ever seen someone on the wards reading the print version but not knowing that you wrote it?
Oh my goodness, so many. Yeah, so many. We had a lady in not that long ago, and she was reading it and she was killing herself laughing. And I was like, oh, what are you reading? And she's like, oh, this book. And she was telling me all about it. And then she went in the shower and I signed it for her. And she came out and she was like, she was so confused. And I went, that's my book. And she went, no, I brought it in with me. And I went, no, I wrote it. And then she was like, what? But I think it's one of the things you don't expect to see your author in the hospital looking after you. But it's really nice. It's really humbling as well.
So a Glasgow kiss, What Happens in Dubai, Meet Me in Milan and Hot Girl Summer, all by my guest Sophie Gravia, are available in print, as an ebook, and in audio, as read by Kira Lucchese. And Sophie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robert. Thank you.
Thanks again to Sophie Gravia, Isabel Ashton and Sue Moorcroft. Sophie Gravier's interview, where we talk about Hot Girl Summer and her Glasgow Kiss trilogy, can be found in Read On number 387. Sue Moorcroft was on episode 167, and Isabel Ashdown was on episode 386. And they're all available wherever you get your podcasts. It's all free. Search for R&IB Read On. That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 450 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for R&IB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the R&IB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.